KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Pop Now 2014. From Friday, July 18th until Sunday, July 20th, PDX Pop Now will host bands on two stages, celebrating and supporting all ages music in the city of Portland, with bands such as The Bugs, The Portland Cello Project, The Estranged, Purse Candy, Orchestra Pacific Tropicale, Summer Cannibals, and many more. PDX Pop will take place at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Avenue in Portland. More information about PDX Pop Now 2014 can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, your community radio. Coming up at 9 o'clock right now, next, in Veterans Voice, Marvin, Bill, and Angie speak with Scott Olson, a Gulf War veteran who was seriously injured by Oakland police during an Occupy rally. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report from the ground in Gaza from a hospital under heavy Israeli attack. Thomas Stevens of Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management talks about poor people, water, and the move to privatize the water system. And the Biggs Beat has commentary on gay white men appropriating black female culture. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with local activists Rachel Townsend and her husband Danny Savedo, who is from Honduras, on the situation in Honduras and how it relates to the children coming to the U.S. fleeing violence in their home country. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
Everywhere, man, we bomb everywhere. Way more than our share, man, we bomb everywhere. We bomb the mountains bare, man, found the desert air. Oh boy, don't we care, man, cause we bomb everywhere. We've bombed in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo.
Can you hear her?
Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia, ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran, time to attack, yeah, we bomb everywhere. Way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We got family values and moral majority. Peace, love, Jesus, top priority. Do unto them for the do unto us. The kingdom come in nuclear dust. Monumental profits being made for the big shareholders in the old arms trade. They lust for the dust of a mushroom cloud. It's making them all American proud. Yeah, heat seeker, bunker buster, daisy cutter, napalm, phosphorus, uranium, smart bomb, A-bomb, predator, prowler, raptor, raven, tomahawk, hellfire, flags are waving. We bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Oh boy, ain't we fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. Our vision of peace has become a ghost, but we're number one, we bomb the most. Soldiers coming home, suicidal, we sit and watch. American Idol, Saudi, Serbia, Mexico, Kosovo, Romania, Germany, load them up, here we go, another verse. Life gets worse, just watch your show and wait for the glow. Well, someday soon we'll all have nukes, true world democracy. Extermination of all life, high possibility. We'll ask your child what they suggest to prevent mass destruction and bring this world in line with love and a brotherhood connection. De-escalate your mental state, incinerate your tools of fate, build no more weapons or rejuvenate our planet's fate. Drop food, medicine, clothes, and tools the children wish you'd see. That will win most the hearts and minds before you count to three. Then we'll bomb everywhere, man, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, man, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We'll bomb in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, are streaming on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you'd like to hear some of our older shows, you can go to kboo.fm/Veterans Voice, which is one word. I'm Marvin, and today Mr. Bill's here.
Good morning, y'all.
And Angie's here.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking with Scott Olson. Scott's a Gulf War veteran, and he's a victim of the Oakland, California Police Department who shot him in the face, Scott?
In the head, not the face.
In the head. Yeah. And we're going to be talking to Scott about how that came about. But first, I got a few announcements to make, and then we'll get going with Scott here. There's going to be a rally. It's called No More U.S. Bombs on Iraq Rally. It's going to be Saturday, July 26th, noon at Terry Shrunk Plaza. And let's make that a big one. You know, they're still doing it, so we got to support Dan Handelman and the folks at Peace and Justice Work. So that's Saturday, July 26th, noon at Terry Shrunk Park. Plaza, right?
Mm-hmm.
Plaza.
Yeah. Yes.
And also, our brothers and sisters at the C-123 Veterans Association, you know, the pilot. Were you here, Andrew, when we talked to Wes about that? And they're still having a lot of problems with the Veterans Administration on getting medical care. And what it is those planes were used to spray Agent Orange in Vietnam. And these guys, men and women, were piloting those planes here in the States after the war. And they're coming down with the same diseases that we got over in Vietnam from Agent Orange. And they're just getting a runaround on it. They're trying to deny them. They're just make up all these laws, Bill. They were doing one where they just made something. They just made it up out of the air.
Yeah.
To deny these guys all the help they need, you know, medical help they need. And so Wes and those folks are still fighting that out. And, you know, if you want, you can give Ron Wyden or Jeff Merkley a call and tell them to support these C-123 Veterans Association and get them some medical help. And if they turn these guys down for that, you know, they're having trouble. The Blue Water Navy guys are having trouble too.
That's right.
You know, trying to get help from Agent Orange and the Brown Water Navy, which were guys on the rivers inside Vietnam, they're not having as much trouble. But the Blue Water Navy, they're still having a lot of problems. And this morning we got a Vietnam an interview. It's going to be live performance and book release. And it's going to be Saturday, August 9th, and it's going to be at the First Unitarian Church. And it's going to it's marking the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And if you remember, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was where they said that two American Navy ships on August 10th, 1964, were attacked by North Vietnamese torpedo boats, and it turned out to be false. That they weren't attacked by them, and it was just all false. And Johnson and the right wingers used that as an excuse to start bombing North Vietnam.
But I think they knew it wasn't true at the time.
Oh, they knew it wasn't true. They were just looking for an excuse to go and start bombing to get into the war, deeper into the war. You know, they have this habit of making stuff up when they want to go to a war. And who pays the price? We do. We do, and the people of Vietnam definitely paid a price. And so that's going to be Saturday, August 9th at First Unitarian Church. And if you'd like more information on that, you can give Lee Jones a call. Her number is 541-554-7182. Our Mark Waskinski, I'm not too sure, at 360-698-9123. And it's also part of the Returning Veterans Project, which we've had on our show a couple times. And really good people, really working hard.
It's worthwhile.
Very good people. And you can get a hold of Sarah Smith from Returning Veterans Project. You can call this number 503-228-6389, and that's the First Unitarian Church. But if you want to get a hold of the Returning Veterans Project, you can email Sarah at Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at Returning Veterans org, and that's all one word, org. And it looks like it's really going to be a really good presentation. And Bill was looking at it earlier, and I was looking at it. It's sponsored by Oregon's Returning Veterans Project, First Unitarian Peace and Social Justice Committee, and with support from the Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics, which is a good thing. So if you want to go see that, that's pretty good. We'll leave a copy of this out on the front desk if people need to get some more information on that. And I don't know, Angie, did you see this in the Oregonian? Guard aims to help vets avoid suicide.
No.
Did you see that? It was Bill, did you see it?
Yes, I saw it.
Yeah, it was a really interesting article about the veterans here in the state of Oregon. We only make up about 8.7% of the population of Oregon, but we make up 23% of all suicides.
Yeah.
23% of all suicides are from veterans. And the largest segment of suicide victims are men over age of 55. And for veterans under age 45, suicide is the leading cause of death, according to the report. And so it just the whole article was just talking about the really high suicide rate that we have here in Oregon. And, you know, there's a military helpline that if you're having trouble, if you're a vet and you're having trouble, you can call this hotline. And it's 888-457-4838. And you can get some help on that. And up on the hill, we call it the hill, here in Portland, it's the Veterans Hospital up on the hill, and you can get a hold of those folks also and get into some health care up there dealing with the suicide and the suicide rate here in Oregon. And
or there's a Portland Vet Center too.
Yeah, the Portland Vet Center, right. The Portland Vet Center is another really good one, and folks can get a hold of those, get a hold of them. And the suicide rate on veterans is just nationwide, it's just really, really high. And so it goes to say something about what they put us through. And before we start with Scott, I want to talk about one more little thing, and well, a couple really. 71% of all Americans now do not support any kind of military action in Iraq.
Yeah,
71% do not support any military action in Iraq, and they just, you know, they don't listen to what the American people. A government that's not afraid of its people can walk all over them, and that's what this government is doing. They're walking all over us. There's, and the, you know, we talk about the suicide rate, and I wonder why, and they're sending us to war all over the country, all over the world. And one of the things that we did a show a long time ago, well, not that long ago, we did it on civilian deaths in war. And the highest percentage of people who die in a war are civilians. You know, the highest percentage that they talked about was 90% of all people killed in certain wars are all civilians. And most of those deaths are women and children and older men. And when you look at that, you know, you know, people say, well, they don't target civilians. Well, that's a lie. You know, they are targeted. Look what's happening right now in Palestine.
Yeah.
You know, look what's happening in Palestine. It's just horrible, all those children. I have a picture. Someone sent me a picture a few years back, and it was of after an attack in Syria, and it was all children. All the dead were children, and it was just the most horrible thing that you could see. And
and that goes for drone strikes in Pakistan too.
Yep,
that's something like one supposed militant killed for every 15 children, Pakistani children killed by drone strike.
By drones, and they just keep using those drones. They just keep using those drones, and there's such horrible things. And that's
we also shouldn't be recruiting kids to build them here in the U.S.
Really?
Yeah. they're actually, some of the places that they're building them, they're sending out people to schools to actually talk to kids about how great it is to have a future in building drones.
Wow. That I didn't know.
One of the places is happening is in Northern California.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. They had, wasn't it built down in the Columbia River Gorge? Wasn't there a place down there that built drones?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And they were, but did you ever hear about that, Angie?
Not really.
Yeah, there was this company down there that did drones.
Stevenson, right across from Hood River. Yeah. I think there's a part of the installation is on the Oregon side now, too.
Yeah, and they're building all these drones to kill children around the world. And, you know, we've played that song, We Bomb Everywhere, for quite a few times, but I've never, you know, the guy who did it is Marcus Jones. His name's Marcus Jones, and he made that song, and, you know, we play it all the time, and I just wanted to, if you're listening, Marcus, we just want to thank you for making that song and sending it to us, bringing it to us, and we play it a lot. And people have taken it from me and used it, so it gets played a lot on every place. We Bomb Everywhere, which is a pretty, pretty interesting thing. But I want to get to our guest now, and then we'll let Angie go ahead and start this interview for us.
All right, here we go. Everybody strap in.
Hold on.
Strap in.
We're going
down
somewhere. We don't know where. So I actually want to just maybe start out by asking why you joined. Where you joined from, like, maybe we can kind of start at the beginning. Because I think that why people join, like their motivations for joining, I think it's important.
Right, and I suppose there were a few reasons why I joined the Marine Corps. This was in 2005, and I was just graduating high school. And, you know, like I saw my parents putting my sister through college, and I knew that they could probably do that for me as well, but I didn't really want that extra pressure on them as well. And so there was like that factor. College was like getting, and is still getting, you know, the cost of college are skyrocketing.
Yeah,
and
the tuition hikes.
And then, but you know, and also on top of that, I bought the lies that we're all fed, basically. And I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. Something, you know, patriotic. Our country's at war. You know, I had that sense of duty to step up and do something. No matter how misguided that is in hindsight. So, you know, I just... Operation Iraqi Freedom, right? And, like, I wanted to liberate the Iraqi people and, you know... I bought these stories that they tell us about them, and they're true. And I wanted to be a part of, you know, giving them democracy, right? Yeah. And things
more
like
rights.
This. Right. And
better life.
Yeah. And, you know, and then, you know, it took me a while, and after I was in Iraq, I realized that it's not about Operation Iraqi Freedom is not about liberating the Iraqi people. It's more about liberating Iraqi oil fields and ensuring that our corporations have access to that. And it's about our corporations' right to have access to that. It has nothing to do with the Iraqi people.
What years were you in?
I was in the Marine Corps from July 2005 to November 2009. And I went to Iraq in 2006, 2007, and then again in 2008.
And what was your MOS is what was your job in the Marine Corps?
I was in communications. Uh-huh. My primary job was like data communications, working with computers and
right.
stuff. And
okay.
I was with an infantry battalion, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, out of 29 Palms, California. And... you know, the day I got orders to that unit is like the day I knew I was going to Iraq in a few months. And
how'd you feel about that?
Yeah, yeah.
I almost figured when I was going through my initial training, I almost figured that I would be going to Iraq, but it was like a different experience, or like it was not real, right? And then, you know, I got orders, and like, because there was still a chance that I could have gone to another unit that was going to be in like Okinawa and not doing too much.
Go ahead.
But you know, so I got the orders to infantry battalion, and I knew I'd be going there.
So then, when you ended up going over there, what were some of the thoughts? How long did it take you to change your perception? How, because you went in with a perception of service, you wanted to help people, you mm-hmm. wanted to do good about the Iraqi people, and then that kind of unraveled. Was that something that you got there, you saw something, and then you realized, like, this isn't what I thought it was, or did it take time?
It was a slow process, yeah. And you know, and it's just like a lots of either little or big experiences that led me to that conclusion, you know. And just one of the things is I was involved with helping the like the police transition team who worked with Iraqi police. I was helping with them with their communication. So I go to the Iraqi police stations and help them set up their Skype so they could talk to the other police stations in the area. And so, like, being involved with that, I was like also like privy to some of the conversations around them and around like the corruption that was endemic in the Iraqi police, and how the rank and file Iraqi police officers were not getting paid. And
they weren't getting paid at all.
They were lucky to get paid, yeah. Right? And you know, there was like high levels of corruption of the Iraqi police officers, you know, just skimming it for themselves, and that meant the rank and file was not getting paid. So, you know, we have all these Iraqis who are trying to do the right thing, trying to provide for their families, and they get nothing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then somebody comes along and offers them a few thousand dollars to plant a bomb against us, you know, and that happened. And, you know, having both sides of that story kind of helped me understand, like, why these people were planting bombs against us. And, like,
right,
you know, they have to, number one, survive and provide for their families. And number two, they were defending themselves against an occupying force. And
they were desperate.
They were desperate. And if that means they're going to be an Iraqi policeman, if they might have been opposed to that, but if they think they can get paid and, like, make a living off that, they were doing it, right? But then they don't get paid. So it's like, what do you expect when these things happen?
Yeah. So then you were in for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were going to be... Then you had an incident happen. Do you want to talk about that at all, or do you want to just skip over that?
Sure, yeah.
In
yeah.
Iraq? Something happened in Iraq?
Something happened with his discharge.
Whoa. Really? I want to ask you another question before we get there. But I want to know about that. Sure. That's interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
What, you know, when in your unit, before you, when you guys got your notice that you were going to go to Iraq, you went twice.
Yeah.
Twice. And the first time you went, was there any other folks in your unit that didn't want to go? Or was it pretty much the whole group would say, hey, let's go do it?
There was no, like, nobody, like, exactly said they didn't want to go, but, like, there was, and this is all it was just, like, you know, casual questioning of, like, what are we really doing here, mm-hmm. you know, and, like, questioning our mission. But that's about the extent that it was.
Okay.
There was no, like, organized resistance or anything like this, or...
Were you there after the fall of Baghdad or before the fall of Baghdad?
It was after. I was there in 2006.
2006?
Yeah, it was like, and I was in Alambar Province, like, and it was, that was at like the height of the sectarian civil war, and my first time over, we got extended by a couple months to stay for the surge.
Oh, so you got extended. I bet that made some guys pretty unhappy.
We were about a month from headed back here, and like, oh, no, you got another 2 months to go.
So. Oh, that just had to make the morale go way down. So when you got back to the States after your first tour, how long were you in the States before you got sent back over?
So, let's see. So we ended up getting back in May of 2007, and then we went back over in February of 2008.
Wow.
For
really?
Another 8 months.
Another 8 months. What was the feeling of the, was was there a big difference in attitudes this time, the second time over, than it was the first time?
No, not really. I mean, the second time, it was like, it was a lot more calm as far as like attacks against us, like, there weren't as many IEDs, and we didn't have nobody from our battalion died that time. Mm. But you know, it was like still the same stupid fight.
Same
and,
stupid
like,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you got back over, was there any kind of dissent among the troops while you were in Iraq?
No.
None.
No.
Okay. Angie, you had a question?
Yeah, I thought it was a little interesting what we were talking about before. If you're willing to talk about that, I find it pretty repulsive how your discharge was handled, and that would probably explain why somebody, anybody, not you, not just you, but anybody, why somebody would be upset. And I can't actually imagine anybody not being upset had they had that happen to you, to them, what happened to you.
Right. So people aren't left in the dark. I'll explain a little bit about what happened with my discharge. And after I got back from my second deployment, I had like about a year and a half left on my contract.
4 year contract?
I had a 5 year contract.
5 year. Wow.
And I was, after my second deployment, I got sent to like a non-deployable base unit in Camp Pendleton. And after a few months of being there, I end up like testing positive on a urinalysis for cocaine. And I had never even used marijuana, cocaine. I only like, drank and smoked cigarettes and drank coffee as well. But like those were the only drugs I had done before then. And so, yeah, like, and they tell me that I tested positive for cocaine and that they were charging me with this. And I kind of knew right then that I was probably going to get an other than honorable discharge, which is what happened. But they still kept me around for another 6 months or so doing my same job and still doing the same thing. And then they discharged me with a other than honorable discharge, which means that I... so far, I've gotten no help, no care, medical care from the VA, nothing from the VA, and...
No GI Bill?
No GI Bill. Nothing.
Why do you think that happened? Do you think they screwed up, or do you think they're trying to save money, or...?
Yeah. Did they retest you?
No. We tried to have them retest me, but that was not an option, I guess.
What about your command? Did you go to your chain of command at all about that?
That's where the problem came from. They were the ones charging me.
Do you think they were trying to get you kicked out?
You know, I'm really not sure. Yeah. I don't know if it was an honest mistake or if there were other forces at work. But, you know, I do know that during that time, the Marine Corps was in a size of downsizing. Coming home from Iraq, and I was in for 4.5 years, and I had about 6 months to go before I would have rated all this care from the VA. So I don't know. I think it was an easy way for them to save a lot of money from the VA. And
it's possible. I mean, it could be.
I mean,
but you should have just told him you drank too much coffee.
And you know, and if that's the effect that they're trying to have or not, that's the effect that it did have.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They did save a lot of money by them not, you know, caring for me anymore. And
were there some people in the same boat that you were in?
Oh, yeah. Just about every veteran of our generation that I talked to knows somebody that that's happened to.
Yeah, it's not just you.
Yeah. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. This is Veterans Voice. We're talking with Scott Olson about his time in the Marine Corps, and it doesn't sound good. And Angie was asking him about his discharge, and Scott was talking about how they treated him on his discharge, and they didn't retest you. They didn't give you another test.
See, it kind of wouldn't matter, Marvin, because cocaine's out of your system in 3 days.
Oh.
Right. So okay. Yeah, it wouldn't have really mattered. But even at the discharge hearing, which is pretty much a kangaroo court,
right?
We had like three of my direct supervisors testify, and like they all said, like, even if they thought I was using cocaine, even if they found out I was using cocaine, they still want to keep me because I was like an asset. I did work. I wasn't problematic. You know, I knew my stuff and I did it.
Right.
So. They still wanted to keep me, but that wasn't enough for the officers on the discharge board to
overturn that.
Right.
So when you you got your dishonorable.
No, it's between an honorable and a dishonorable. It's other than honorable.
But no, other than honorable.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so, but it took away your any kind of help from the VA.
Right.
No, and no school, no medical or anything because of that discharge.
And I'm working on that, working with a great group out of San Francisco called Swords to Plowshares.
Yeah, wonderful.
And they're helping with that.
They're wonderful.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, that happened, Angie, that happened in Vietnam.
Did it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that happened a lot in Vietnam that they were, you know, wanting to get rid of guys, and so they were, you know, charging them with drug problems, and the guys were getting less than honorable discharges, and they just went through the ranks.
It's almost like they just pick a name and do it.
It seemed like but Vietnam did have a bad drug problem.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I mean, they had a really bad drug problems, but they were discharging guys for drug use and just different things like that, and. Giving them bad discharges, just bad discharges. And I remember talking to a guy who had gotten a bad discharge, and he was trying to get it upgraded, you know. And I was talking to him about it, and I said, well, how's it going? He said, you know, the guy that's helping me isn't really helping me. You know, he's saying, all you're doing this for is because you want medical care, you know. You know. You're just doing it because you want something from the government.
Isn't that kind of like what they tell you, the reason why you should go
into
it?
How selfish of him, right?
How selfish of you. Served in the military and you need help, and you know, and they gave you a bad discharge, and so they're going to not give it to you. And so you got your discharge, and what'd you do once you got your discharge? What'd you do?
Well, I ended up moving back to the Midwest and doing like the same job. I was working in IT, working on computers in the civilian sector after that. And for a while that was in Illinois, and then I found a job in San Francisco with a software company and moved out to the Bay Area. And that was a couple years after I got out. That was summer 2011. And then shortly after that is around the time when Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland we're starting.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the next chapter of my story, I guess.
Yep.
Flip the page. Chapter 2, Scott's story. Then he discovered Iraq Veterans Against the War somehow.
You are a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yes.
Ah, great group. Great. Yeah.
So how did you come across them?
Yeah.
You know, I saw some of their videos on YouTube, some of their Winter Soldier testimonies, and you know, it really spoke to me to be able to like hear other veterans talking about the same issues that I was thinking about, the same issues that I thought were like a minority opinion among veterans. And it was really like comforting to be able to like know that there are others who have come to the same conclusion that I had, and like that there was a community of veterans to mm-hmm. plug in with and to support and be supported by.
Right. So did you go to a lot of their rallies? And
I went to a couple of things in Chicago when mm-hmm. I was living in Illinois, but on the other side of the state. So I went to a couple of things in Chicago, and once I got to the Bay Area, I could like plug in a lot better because there was a more active chapter there.
Oh, yeah. Big chapter.
Oh, yeah.
There in the Bay Area, there's a big veterans movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the, you know, peace veterans movement. Yeah. It's pretty big. And so I want to start talking about, you were part of IVAW. You were part of Occupy.
Yeah.
And now let's talk about what happened.
Okay.
Get serious here.
So, you know, like on October 25th, 2011, that morning, the Oakland police raided Oscar Grant Plaza, which is where Occupy Oakland was set up at, and they evicted them from the plaza in the morning. And then I heard about this throughout the day, and I was at work at my job, and after I got done with
I
that...
I thought occupiers didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're all lazy bums, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, so after I got off of work, I headed over to Oakland to offer them my support, be there, and you know, be present with them. And I guess I got to... I took the subway under the bay, got to Oakland, and joined the demonstration. They were at 14th and Broadway in downtown Oakland. It's mm-hmm. right outside Oakland City Hall.
Yeah.
Where they were set up, and like there was a line of cops and
lot of them.
Oh, yeah, like probably
a lot of cops.
Yeah. At least
have you
50,
seen the video, Marvin?
No.
The video online. There's video online of all this going down, and there's a line of people, and then there's Scott and another IVAW member in full Navy dress blues.
Oh, really?
Holding a Veterans for Peace flag uh-huh. in front, and a whole line of cops. And the video is actually pretty telling.
Mm.
Anyways, sorry.
Yeah, so I guess the cops didn't like us being there, and they ordered us to disperse. We did not disperse, so they attacked us. They threw tear gas grenades at us, flashbangs at us, and that's how it started.
Smoke
and like
canisters
these,
too, right?
Yeah, like the tear gas canisters mm-hmm. yeah. and then the flashbangs. And these are munitions that are designed to cause a crowd to panic and to disperse in mostly unpredictable ways. So, in, you know, Oakland Police's strategy, they then follow that up with shooting beanbags out of shotguns.
They did or didn't?
That's what they do.
Yeah, right.
And one of those beanbags hit me in the head. And beanbag sounds rather innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's 40 grams of birdshot, 40 grams of lead pellets in a sock, basically, and it's mm-hmm. fired out of a shotgun at a high velocity. And one of them hit me in the head from a range of about 15 feet.
15 feet?
Yeah.
My gosh, that
and,
was close.
And then, you know, ooh. Which knocked me down.
Which I just want to point out, the crowd was relatively calm.
Oh yeah.
When this happened, the crowd was not freaking out. The crowd wasn't
tossing
attacking
bottles and
no. The crowd wasn't attacking the police in any way. The police initiated the attack.
Oh yeah.
So they threw tear gas. They threw the flash and bang, which is a grenade that
makes
flashes
a flash
and bangs.
And bang. Yeah.
Makes a lot of noise. And so they threw the, they did that, and then they opened up with the shotguns with the bean bags. Did they use the wooden dowels? Did they fire wooden dowels?
No, I think Oakland Police had those taken away from them a few years ago.
Yeah, because they did use them down on the docks.
Yeah, in 03, they used them, and they got them taken away after that.
So they didn't use those, but they did the bean bags. And right. So how many, wow, I'm going to watch that. I listened to some stuff that you had talked about, but I didn't know that was on there. And so they fired their bean bags at you. They hit you in the head.
Yeah, and then a crowd of other people there, other demonstrators who were there, a crowd of them gathered around me and shouted medic and were trying to render care or evacuate me. And after they gathered around me, another police officer threw a flashbang right at us.
To disperse them from helping you.
Precisely.
To keep them from helping you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
you can see this in the video.
Yeah, if you look on YouTube for Scott Olson Oakland, that's enough to get you these videos.
So, Scott, besides you, was anybody else shot?
A couple of other people were hit in the leg with beanbags and stuff, but like by far I was like the most seriously injured that night. So some other protesters like gave me a ride to the hospital since the cops weren't going to...
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you.
Oh, no, they weren't going to give me an ambulance or whatever. But so yeah, they left it up to us, to the protesters who like risk their own well-being to evacuate me out of there. And they took me into the hospital. And I was there for about 2.5 weeks in the hospital. I had to have brain surgery and skull reconstruction and all these things.
Really?
You had a fractured skull, right?
Right.
You had internal bleeding in your brain, right?
Right. Yeah, and that was enough to forever kill part of my left frontal lobe.
So when you were in the hospital, did the cops or the attorneys for the city come and try to arrest you or try to get you to sign papers that you wouldn't go to sue them or something? Were you ever talked to by the cop?
Well, you know, apparently I was talked to, and I think it was that night by two police officers. I don't remember it.
Right.
I had just had a serious brain injury and was on a lot of morphine at the time, too.
Right.
Yeah, they recorded that, and our legal team got a copy of that recording, and they are... They're dicks to me. They're not.
They lied to you.
Well, like they were trying to get me to like just give them something and just like say like, oh, get me to say like, oh, I saw other people throwing bottles or, you know, like my buddy was doing this.
Trying to get
some... And I couldn't say that because I couldn't talk at the time and that didn't happen. So yeah, they were just not. You know, it's a very unpleasant conversation, but I can't quite remember it. And like just seeing the video of them doing that, it's like,
yeah. So when you were in the hospital, they had to operate on you for sure, right?
Right. Yeah, it was a couple of days later. My head was still swollen, and they had to cut me open to put my skull back together and make sure. I don't know what they did, but yeah, they had to cut me open.
And so after you were in for 2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you sued them.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Well.
Who helped you? Who was your...
My attorney was Jim Channon, who he was one of the attorneys on the Riders case in Oakland and the 03 case. And also Rachel Letterman, and she's with the National Lawyers Guild.
Right.
And so, yeah, they were my attorneys, and, you know, it was great to be able to have more of an advocate on my side.
Right.
And, yeah, we just settled earlier this year.
Did the police, I mean, were they, it makes me so angry, were they... Angie,
What he was trying to ask you is, did they ever apologize or anything?
Yeah. No.
No, of course not. I asked you that before. I asked him that before. Mm-hmm. Did they ever give like a formal apology?
Yeah, that's
did
what I ever, wanted to know.
You know, nothing though. Just nothing. They don't care.
No statement or anything from the police department.
No.
Nope. So Oakland Police Department ain't got no good reputation.
They have a horrible reputation.
They're like the worst of the worst, and they're the one police department that does not.
Yeah,
they're so horrible. Far they're not getting better.
What did you say about something about what happened to the guy that actually threw the flashbang when they were the police officer that threw the flashbang when the crowd was trying to help you? Something happened with him.
Yeah, he was his position was terminated about a year ago. So about like a year after it happened, they terminated his position, but it wasn't for his conduct. It was because he lied to the investigators about his placement.
Yeah.
He's contesting that right now, and might be getting his job back.
Really?
Yeah.
That's just like here when that. We'll talk. That'd make you mad too. But
Marvin's getting so mad he can't talk. Yeah,
mad. How did the news media treat you? How did the news media in Oakland Bay Area treat you? Were they on your side, or were they kind of dancing with the police?
They were pretty sympathetic towards me, and yeah, like they've always like asked me or talked to me when they see me at a protest or whatever, and you know, if there's ever like a time when we've needed to publicize anything, like they've been a pretty good, like, surprisingly good ally that we've had.
So did the city took no responsibility. You had to sue them. You beat them.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you get your health care now? Because I mean, you're going to have health care the rest of your life,
right? And
was that part of the settlement?
Well, you know, it's I got enough to where I'll be able to like purchase private health insurance. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's not quite ideal, but but it'll have to work.
Right.
And even for a while, like in 2012, like about 6 months after I was shot, like I could no longer afford health insurance.
Right.
And I was paying Cobra for a while, and I couldn't afford it anymore, so like I had to let my health insurance drop.
Right.
And then I had trouble getting it back once my lawyer, I got after new lawyers, right, and they were like, oh, your old lawyer should not have let this happen. So
right,
like, they tried to get me back on it, and I wasn't able to get it until the first of this year.
Oh.
Because I had a pre-existing
condition, right. Right. So what about, you said you were working at the time, you had a job in IT. Uh-huh. So after these monsters shot you and hurt you, what happened with that job?
Well, about like a month or two after I got, or a couple months after I got out of hospital, I tried going back to work, and I was doing about like 20-hour weeks.
Mm-hmm.
and basically it didn't work out. I was working for them for a month. I wasn't very productive. Like, right, I had a lot of trouble with multitasking and like dealing with like a lot of complex information, which was key for the job that I was doing.
Right,
And basically I forgot to go into work one day. They wanted me to come in on some extra day. I forgot about it. And
mm-hmm.
and that was that. They fired me after that.
They did.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it was probably better for the both of us. Like, mm-hmm. I could go back to work now, and I probably wouldn't be nearly as productive as I was.
There's
like
no
it's not realistic for me to like work a full time job.
No. Did you get to draw unemployment, or did you get any money for unemployment from after you got you got fired?
Right.
Could you draw unemployment or anything like that?
No. I didn't.
You didn't try.
I tried, but I think like, I don't know, like, I think because of some of the terms on which I was fired, I think I was ineligible.
Yeah, yeah. That is just unbelievable.
Sounds like you're probably
in the effort to get your discharge upgraded.
Yeah, I'm working with Swords of Plowshares on that.
Yeah,
but
Plowshares.
Just like anything, it's Fahey. Like a long process. And
is Dan Fahey part of the Plowshares still?
I'm not sure.
Not sure. Interesting. So how do you think that's going to work out?
I mean, like, I don't know. It's really hard to predict these things. I mean, we right. can talk in, like, real terms, and, like, I didn't do anything wrong. I had a good record in the military. I deployed mm-hmm. twice, and it was only one alleged count of misconduct.
Right.
And so anybody with, like, a actually working mind would be able right. to tell you, like, yeah, that should work. You should be able to get upgraded, right. no problem. But it's the military we're dealing with.
Yeah, you're talking military.
The VA
yeah.
we're dealing with. Yeah. So it's always like, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem with the VA. So what are you doing now? I mean, I know you're part of IVAW.
Mm-hmm.
And going around the state, do you do a lot of talking with IVAW, or do you go to school? Because Angie goes to lots of schools and talks in schools. And
yeah, I've done like some amounts of like talking to high schools and high school kids. But I've also like had like some take a lot of time for myself.
Oh
and,
yeah,
you know, it's been like a really stressful couple of years, and essentially like my life's been almost on pause while this lawsuit has been going.
Right.
And so, you know, even aside from the settlement that I got from the city, like just having that situation change to where now I'm in like a position where I can move forward
right.
instead of always having to worry about this
right.
lawsuit or always having to worry about this and that, you know, it's given me a lot more agency to be able to take care of things, and it's been good for my mental health to
right.
not have to worry about so much.
The big load off your back.
Right. So, yeah, I'm right now I'm just trying to, like, take care of things that I've been putting off for a couple of years mm-hmm. and, you know, taking care of myself.
Yeah, I think that's really important that you take care of yourself. That's probably the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
How about your family? When you were shot by these pigs, these horrible, horrible people, was your family supportive of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, and, you know, they live in Wisconsin. I'm from Wisconsin,
right.
and they live there, and, you know, my sister found out about it, like, 6 hours after I was shot. She found out about it by, like, seeing the video posted on Facebook.
Right.
Wow. You know, here's your brother getting shot. And then, yeah, and they were, like, hounded by the media.
Oh, I just asked.
Oh, yeah, and, but,
right.
yeah, you know, they've been very supportive, and you know, I'm happy that they have been that way. And
yeah,
because I know that's not always the case, right?
Yeah. So you're living in the Bay now. Are you living in Oakland?
In Oakland. Yeah.
You're living in Oakland.
Yeah.
I used to work on. I lived down there for Hayward for a while. I worked down on East Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. 14th and East Broadway.
Right.
pretty by the Fruitvale Station, BART
yep.
Station.
Yeah.
That was a pretty tough area at that time.
Do you feel that you've recovered completely, or are there long-range problems that you're looking forward to or not looking
yeah.
forward to?
Well, you know, like, yeah, after a serious brain injury, there's no such thing as a complete recovery.
Right.
Comparing myself to where I was about 2 years ago, I'm doing a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You're improving.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I've improved.
Uh-huh.
And I've kind of, like, hit a point where, like, I do have lots of, like, cognitive issues that are, they're not very visible. But, like, you know, things like memory, getting fatigued really
mm-hmm.
easily. And, you know, like, and I've seen a lot of doctors, and, like, I saw, like, a couple of them have, like, said that I'm at a very good, moderately good risk to, like, developing dementia by, like, middle or old age.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's something I get to look forward to, you know?
Yeah. Wow. That is just amazing. Amazing.
That's pretty shameful that that's how the police treat
people. That's pretty shameful how they did
for
that.
For executing the constitutional rights that veterans have sworn to protect when they joined the military in the first place.
Right. Yeah. And like, that was part of my mindset when I went there. It's like, you know, when I went to the process in Oakland, it's like, these are the freedoms that I thought I was defending. Let's see how this works.
Yeah.
Right.
Didn't work out well.
Nope.
So you had to sue the city.
You found out how it worked.
Yeah, right. pretty fast. So you had to sue the city.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure they fought you.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't want to take any
excuse
responsibility.
They could come up with. No, it was this police department. No, that was not us, or it was whatever.
But yeah. We wouldn't do anything like that.
I just can't imagine. And they probably... Oh, I'm so sorry that they did that to you. That's so horrible, man.
Do you know how many people were at that protest approximately?
A
couple hundred?
It was 100? Around, yeah, it was at least, it was like between 300 and 500.
So mm-hmm. Pretty big.
Yeah, it was like, it was the whole intersection was pretty much full of people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite a few people.
Wow, Scott, that's great. We're just about out of time, and we've been talking to Scott Olson. As a Gulf War vet, member of Iraqi Veterans Against the War, and was shot by a beanbag by the Oakland Police Department, and
seriously injured.
Seriously injured by the Portland Police Department, by Oakland Police Department. Scott, we're glad you came, buddy. Thanks for
coming
and talking with us. And we'll be back on August 15th. At the same time, and I think we're probably going to be talking with Marcus Reese, who has written a book about problems with the VA, and so we'll probably be talking with him next month. And Angie, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And Bill, thanks.
You're welcome.
And thanks for being our engineer. And Tammy, it should be back next month. And so thanks a lot, folks. And if you you can go on KBOO.FM and you can join KBOO by going up and hitting the tip jar, and you'll become a member of KBOO. And we've been on the radio over 20 years, and we want to keep our radio station going. And we'll be back on August 15th at 9 a.m. on Veterans Voice Radio Show. And there it is.
For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close a missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. I ain't marching anymore.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Coming up is Air Cascadia, news, headlines, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre. Keep it locked right here, 90.7 FM, your community radio.
Cascadia. Today is Friday, July 18th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.